Restoration Theology number 14, comparative theology and alternative doctrines. Comparative theology is not a well-known branch of theology. Catherine Corneal writes in her book, Meaning and Method in Comparative Theology. She writes, in the centuries since its first use, which has been traced back to 1700, the term comparative theology has been used in various ways or applied to different types of engagement with religious plurality. It has been put forth as a counterpart to apologetic approaches to other religions, as proto-comparative religion, as a means to develop a universal or world theology, and as a new form of constructive systematic theology. Now, as restorationists, this last one is what we're interested in. We're interested in constructive systematic theology. I like that turn of phrase. Generally speaking, comparative theology deals with other religions. You're comparing your view of the afterlife to what the Buddhists believe or to what some other religion believes, or you're comparing your view of salvation to what the Muslims believe or whatever, you know, like across religions. That's not how we're using it. We're looking at how other Christian groups, or even better, what other Christian theologies are and those that are different than our own. And the fact that like there's hardly, barely even a label for this is an indication of the need for it, because by and large, Christians are not doing this, and I think we need to do this. Catherine Corneal talks about the confessional approach. This is a totally different approach than what we're taking. The confessional comparative theology approach seeks to deepen, enrich, enhance, or critique the teachings and practices of a given religion without questioning or going beyond its basic beliefs and religious presuppositions. This, of course, sets certain limits to the possibilities of comparative theology. It does not entertain religious questions or practices that have no relevance for the religion seeking to learn from the comparative exercise, and it does not consider the possibility of discovering truth that would fundamentally exceed or clash with the contours of that tradition. So the term typically used by those who have a confessional approach, I covered earlier in this class, is fides quaerens intellectum, faith seeking understanding. The church or the denomination gives you your beliefs, they give you the tradition, they give you the faith. You do not question the faith, you accept it, and then you, if you want to use your mind, you use it to understand why it's already true. To me, that's so lame. Like, come on, that's ridiculous. What if it's not true? And that's why as restorationists, our slogan is fides quaerens veritatem, faith seeking truth. Well, how do we seek the truth? Restoration theology, we employ comparative theology in the pursuit of truth. We're not looking to just understand ourselves better. That's the confessional approach. Like, I already have this confession. I'm just trying to understand myself. No, we want the capital T truth about this or that. And we're willing to change our minds. We're willing to say we're wrong about something. We're willing to grow theologically rather than merely clinging to traditional ideas. Proverbs 12:15 says, fools think their own way is right, but the wise listen to advice. Right? So on the one hand, you have thinking. On the other hand, you have listening. Look, we all think, come on, just be honest. Like, we all think we're right. I think I'm right. You think you're right. The person down the road who has totally different beliefs than either of us, they think they're right. Okay, but to be wise means you listen to advice. It means you listen and you engage. Restorationists are those who think our way is right, but we're willing to listen to the other side. We want to be Bereans, not Thessalonians. And what I mean by that is in Acts chapter 17, we're not going to go there, we already have, but the Thessalonians, when Paul came to them preaching a message, a new message, the people of Thessaloniki, they got upset. They got emotional. They got violent, and they attacked the Apostle Paul, and they ran him out of town. Came to a new town, called Berea. And the people in Berea, we call the Bereans, they listened to Paul's message and they did not get emotional and attack and run him out of town. Instead, you know what they did? They didn't necessarily believe it, but they checked it against the Bible to see if it was true. And then they ended up accepting it. But that mentality is the Berean mindset, not the Thessalonian mindset. That's who we want to be. So how can we do this? Well, first of all, we have to recognize that what your opponent says, what somebody else says who believes something different than you, is just that. It's their opinion. Unless you're in an actual debate on a stage or something where there are high stakes and lots of people watching, just take a breath, man. You don't have to believe what this person is saying. Just try to understand what they're saying. What's their position? Where are they coming from? And then as for your own beliefs, give yourself a pass. You don't have to change your mind right in this moment. You're just gathering data, and when you change your mind about something, it should be because, one, you've taken enough time to thoroughly research the issue. Two, you have encountered one or more defeaters for your position. And three, you find the positive case for another position compelling. Now, when I say defeaters for your position, I mean some sort of reason why your view is wrong. Okay, so that's an argument or a reasoned account as to why your belief is wrong. That's what I mean by defeater. I'm not talking about like feeling depressed or something, feeling defeated. Okay, it's a term used in logic. This should be a slow process. Changing your beliefs should be a slow process. Should not be a fast process. Okay, now there are probably good exceptions to that. I'm just saying in general, it should be a slow process, okay? There might be times, look, if God strikes you by lightning or quickens your heart, hey, it's a fast process, okay? But generally, it should be a slow process. Over and over throughout my life, I've had back burner issues. Now, I know people outside the United States are going to be watching this. I want to explain what I mean by a back burner issue because that's a colloquialism. In the case of many of our stoves, our stovetops, we have burners on the front and in the back. And we do a lot of our work. I was watching my wife tonight. She made a nice potato soup, potato cream soup. It was delicious. She had a big pot and she put in the garlic and the onions and the potatoes and some cream and a lot of things. And it was on the front. And that's how we do it. We typically use the front. If we're going to use the back burner, which is farther to reach, we put something there that we don't need to attend to as vigorously, right? So it'll be something that's just simmering, something in the back that doesn't need constant attention. That's what I mean by a back burner issue. So let me give you an example. Years ago, when I went to Boston University, I took a class by one of these celebrity professor types that has like lots of fans and, you know, a big platform and stuff. Anyhow, she was saying that the Gospel of Luke is wrong about Quirinius. Quirinius is a Roman governor mentioned in Luke chapter 3, and she's like, well, Luke is just wrong about that. And I heard that, and I'm sitting there in the classroom, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I don't really have the time to look into this right now. I'm in college. I'm stressed to the max. I got two kids at home, a third on the way. You know, I can't spare the bandwidth to like launch an investigation on a first century Roman governor and what Luke said about him right now. I got to write this paper on the Gospel of Mark, which is actually the paper I was writing at the time. And you know what? That's fine. I put that issue on the back burner and I just let it simmer there. And then some years later, I was listening to an interview with somebody, and it was a guy named N.T. Wright, very famous Christian theologian, and he had a solution for the problem. And boom, I got the solution. Now, you know, if somebody brings a genuine defeater to your mind, you shouldn't just ignore it forever, but you don't have to answer it right in the moment either. That's what I'm trying to say. Because we have real life to live, we don't always have the time to diffuse every defeater in the moment. But we do want to be intellectually honest and not just ignore everything forever. All right, it's easy to get emotional and attack. I feel that too, but that is not wise. James 3:17 says, "But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield." Ooh, that's a tough one right there, especially for us Americans. Willing to yield, man. Let's start over. I like pure. That's easy, right? The wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, and without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy, right? So we don't want those, and we do want these other things. Instead of letting your emotions take over, concentrate on deciphering the case. If you're going to do comparative theology, that means you're going to listen or read or watch a presentation by somebody who disagrees with you. While you're doing that, you're going to have emotions. You're going to want to attack the guy's hair or his suit or her makeup or, you know, some other thing, right? Just find some sort of way to discredit this person so you don't have to listen. Well, that's not helpful, okay? That's a human impulse. We all have it. We're like, oh, that guy's an idiot. He probably doesn't even love his mother. You know, that's irrelevant if he loves his mother or not. He should love his mother. But if he doesn't love his mother, that doesn't change the force of his arguments, unless he's arguing about whether or not he loves his mother, I suppose. But the point is, concentrate on deciphering the case. What are their reasons for this belief? And what are their main objections against your belief? Are they giving reasons? Or are they appealing to emotion alone? Doubt, I believe, is your servant. This is something I've said many times, but I want to say it again. I believe that doubt is your servant. What do I mean by that? We don't like doubt. We want to avoid doubt. We dismiss, rationalize, and ignore problems. But doubt is really helpful in manageable doses. If you have way too much doubt all at once, obviously that's toxic. But if you have a manageable dose of doubt, it should serve you. How does it serve you? Well, if you doubt something that you happen to be wrong about, and then you go look into it and you find out that you were wrong, that's good for you. It's good for you to be wrong about fewer things. And if you doubt something and then you find out that it's really true, now you've done all this research and now you are strong in your belief. So let's say you're having doubts about God's existence. And you're saying, I never met God. I never heard a voice. I wasn't there at the Red Sea. Who knows? Maybe they made it all up. And so you say to yourself, well, I'm having this doubt about God's existence. I just really want to figure out. And so you do the research and you listen and you read and you come across all these different arguments for God's existence. The cosmological argument, the teleological argument, the argument from fine-tuning, the moral argument. Maybe you even read the ontological argument and even understand why anybody would care what that says. But you come across all these arguments for God's existence, and then you say, you know what? There's also argument from other people's testimony of miracles that they've had. My goodness, there's so many arguments for God's existence. It's actually a really well-established, very robust belief. And now instead of doubt, now that doubt has served you well to do the research, so now you're actually strong in something that you should be strong in. Belief in God's existence. Or let's say instead you doubt whether or not you should be praying to angels. I talked about previously, like some Christians pray to angels. And so let's say you doubt that. Well, good, you should doubt that. It's wrong. So when you doubt that, you go and you read the Bible and you find out nobody else ever prays to angels in the whole Bible. And Jesus says to pray to the Father in his name. And you're, oh man, okay. Maybe I shouldn't pray to angels. Good. See how doubt can be your servant. So don't be afraid of doubt. Doubt will help you strengthen true beliefs and discard false beliefs. And one more thing I want to talk about before I go to method is plausibility and intuition. You have certain sensibilities. You know, you have certain things that you would say, well, these are likely to be true. These are plausible ideas. And then other ideas that you find implausible. So If you wind back the clock a couple hundred years, people used to believe in spontaneous generation. They used to believe, and it's totally logical why. Like, let's say you had some food in a container with no lid. And if you just leave it there, leave it out, you know, on a table in your house in the 1800s, say, for a couple of days, what happens to that food? It seems like it breeds maggots and flies. It seemed to people like, oh, well, maggots just spontaneously generate out of this rotting food. You know how they disproved that? They put a lid on it, and then it didn't breed maggots. And they're like, oh. And then they discovered later on that flies would come and drop little eggs and then leave, and that those eggs would grow into the worms that then turn back into flies, right? So my point is, if it was a couple hundred years ago, and if I said to you, oh, yeah, sometimes stuff just like pops into existence out of nowhere, you'd be like, yeah, I've seen that many times. You know, I leave the food out and it breeds worms. You know, I didn't put those worms in there. The worms just popped in, you know. That was plausible to them. To you as a 21st century person, that is not a plausible notion. You have intuitions, and they're trained by your culture, your society, your family, your experiences. And what I'm telling you is, don't trust them. Do something different. Instead of trusting your sense of what is possible or what is likely to be true or your feelings about your gut and all this, instead of trusting any of that, do something different. Instead, find the reasons and the defeaters. Find the reasons. What are the reasons for that this person is saying that this is true? What are the defeaters against your position or against their position? Plausibility does not necessarily correlate with truth. Your intuitions can be wrong. Your feelings change all the time. It's not a reliable guide, generally speaking, in this area of understanding. All right, so let's talk about method. I've got a four-step comparative theology method. Number one, find out what the other positions are for a given doctrine. Number two, find a good case for each of the views that you don't hold and take notes. Number three, work through the reasons for the other position. And number four, work through the defeaters for your position. All right, let's take them one at a time. First up, find out what the other positions are for a given doctrine. I want to show this by example. When it comes to the timing of the crucifixion of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus, there are three main views. There may be more than three views, but there are three that I'm familiar with. So what I did is I asked AI, this is exactly what I asked AI. I said, what are the main positions for what day of the week Christ died and was raised from the dead? That's what I asked AI. This is what AI spit out. One, the traditional view, most common, Friday crucifixion, Sunday resurrection. Summary, Jesus dies on Friday afternoon, rests in the tomb during Saturday, and rises early Sunday morning. Basis, day of preparation is Friday in Mark 15:42. The women came early on the first day of the week, which is a Sunday, Mark 16:2. And the idea of Jewish inclusive reckoning, counting parts of days as full days. So you could have 3 days, or the third day without it being three full days and three nights. Who holds it? Most Christian traditions and the majority of scholars. So that's view number one. View number two, the Wednesday view. Wednesday crucifixion, Saturday resurrection. Summary, Jesus dies on Wednesday and rises late Saturday, allowing a literal 72 hours. And they cite as the basis for this belief, Matthew 12:40, which has 3 days and three nights taken literally, and John 19:31, which some propose a reference to a high day, is talking about an additional annual Passover Sabbath that year, meaning the Sabbath after the crucifixion might not be a Saturday, but a different day of the week. Who holds this view? Some conservative or literalist interpreters, not widely accepted in scholarship. Number three, the Thursday view, growing support among evangelicals. Thursday crucifixion, Sunday resurrection. Summary, Jesus dies on Thursday afternoon, giving Thursday equal one, day one, Friday's day two, Saturday's day three, and rises early Sunday. Basis, allows more time for the events between death and burial. Still fits inclusive counting, but produces a fuller 3 days. Compatible with the High Sabbath of John 19:31. Who holds it? Well, some evangelical scholars and pastors, still a minority. And then it offered point number four, which I thought was hysterical. The early Sunday resurrection is universal. Regardless of whether Christ died on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, all positions agree on a Sunday morning resurrection, because every gospel places the women at the tomb on the first day of the week. I found this to be so hysterical. So you have these three views, right? You have the Friday, Sunday, the Wednesday, Saturday, and the Thursday, Sunday view. And then in conclusion, they all believe in Sunday. No, they don't. Wednesday, Saturday doesn't believe in Sunday. Anyhow, AI does sometimes get stuff wrong, right? You know, it's not perfect. Think of AI as an assistant, not an expert. Okay, you ask it questions and it does internet searches for you, but it's not an infallible expert that knows all. Okay, that's God. Now that we know what the different positions are for a given doctrine, find a good case for each of the views. Okay, so step one, find out what the views are. Step two, all right, now you got to find somebody that's written a book or that talks about it, you know, maybe on YouTube or a podcast or some other source, where they talk about their view and they present it. Now let's talk about sources. Okay, there's lots of sources. We live in the information age, the digital age. We're going through a major revolution right now with all this artificial intelligence. So let me just talk about sources a little bit. There are blog posts, essays, and journal articles. Out of all of these, journal articles are to be preferred. Journal articles are written by people that, or they're published by institutions that are peer reviewing what people are writing. So unlike a blog post, like literally anybody in the world can write a blog post about anything they want at any time. So there's no accountability. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just there's no checks and balances. So if you have somebody that's like really good, yeah, follow their blog, great. But if you can come to a journal article, then it is actually, in some sense, vetted. It might be vetted by people that hold beliefs that you don't think are right, which I find is often the case for me. But at least it's somehow been tested. Then you have long-form lectures. Notice I wrote the word long-form here. If you're getting your theology from a short vertical video, it's a shallow theology. If you can say it in 30 seconds, guess what? There's not much to it, okay? So prefer the long-form lectures, sermons, or interviews. And then full-length moderated debates, not just two guys yelling at each other. There are some debates where it's just like, it's more heat than light. Let's just put it that way. And there's people talking over each other. I think moderated debates are a little more helpful because a moderator will keep things civilized and disciplined, focused on the next topic, or on the same topic. And then, of course, you have books. Books are the gold standard. If you have eyes and you can read, this is a great time to take advantage of that skill in looking at the case of somebody else. All right, so when you do find somebody's presentation, whether it's something online or written a book or some sort of video thing, you want to steel man and not straw man. Straw man means you misrepresent the other position as weaker than it really is. Steel man is when you present the other position in its strongest form. There is just no value in misrepresenting somebody else's position so you can beat up a fake version of what they're saying. There's just no value in that. That's not what they believe. It's not going to convince them. And it's not helping you either because you didn't take the time to really understand what their position is. So we want to steel man, not straw man. A word about debates. Debates can be helpful. Both sides put forth their best arguments. Both sides research the other, find problems, and expose them. And so debates are like a really concentrated opportunity to hear two different viewpoints, so long as both people are allowed to speak. I'm not going to include presidential debates or vice presidential debates, a lot of political debates, just people talking over each other, okay? I don't find those to be, or let's put it this way, if somebody asks a question and then you talk about something else that's completely unrelated, you're not getting at the truth there. You know what I mean? You're grandstanding. So you want to find quality debates, and you have to understand that debates have a certain form to them. And here's a typical debate format. Each side will present a positive case for their position. So if I'm arguing that chocolate chip cookie dough is the best ice cream, and you're arguing that peanut butter cup is the best ice cream, I'm supposed to have my opening case. Here are my three reasons or five reasons why chocolate chip cookie dough is the best. Okay, now the next person goes. They're not supposed to say chocolate chip cookie dough stinks. And there's no reason why anyone should ever believe in that. And if you do, you're a Nazi. And you probably are a hateful person. You're going to hell. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to offer a positive case for your side, which is peanut butter cup ice cream. Right? So positive case on the one side, positive case on the other side. Then rebuttal. Here's why you're wrong about peanut butter cup ice cream. You know, there's people that are allergic to peanuts. And cookie dough's better tasting or whatever. And then this guy gets to give his rebuttal, right? So you have positive case, rebuttal, rebuttal, cross-examination. That's the exciting part, right? Now one side is going to ask questions and the other side's not allowed to ask questions back. The other side just has to answer the questions. And it's like a lawyer grilling somebody on the stand. And then we flip. And now this person is going to ask the questions and the other guy is going to be in the hot seat, right? And then you have your concluding statement, and then oftentimes questions from the audience. So that's a typical debate format. The downside of this format is that there's really no opportunity for discussion. And there's no opportunity for actually understanding the other person. Most of this stuff is all prepared ahead of time. That's part of the beauty and the limitation of debates, is that they're not going to have a genuine, natural, organic conversation. They're committing to this artificial format so that the audience can see both ideas lined up next to each other in a good way. At least that's the goal. Now, sometimes there will be a book. And so people will have a debate and then they'll be like, you know what, that was really good. Let's write a book together and I'll write my side, you write your side, and we'll interact in the book. Those are actually very helpful too, debate books. Let's talk about books. Oh, one more thing before I get to books. When it comes to debates, you know what you're listening for? Reasons and defeaters. All right, if the person gets up there and waves their arms around and makes comments about the other person's shoes, guess what? That doesn't mean anything. If they just talk in an arrogant way or they make fun of the other person, who cares? Like there's no logical value to that. That's just rhetoric. If this person makes a point and then illustrates it five ways by telling all these stories, guess what? That's still only one point. It's five times illustrated, but it's still just one point. All right, let's go to books. To get a quick summary of many beliefs, pick up a theology textbook, okay? So the first one I have here is Will Barlow's Explore What We Believe. This book is not yet in print, but it should be coming out in the next little while here, next few months. And so it just basically goes through standard Christian beliefs in order, one at a time, and gives you the verses for why he believes in them. A more elaborate book that's more in-depth is Dustin Smith's A Systematic Theology of the Early Church, which is at least twice as thick and much more in detail. And then you have Alva Huffer's Systematic Theology, which is kind of dated now, but it's still pretty good. It's got a lot of good verses and references in there. And I include these three because they all agree with most of my beliefs, right? So that's why I like them. Okay? But guess what? I lost it there for a second. We're not just talking about holding your beliefs that you already hold. What we're actually talking about here is we're talking about comparative theology. They're just not messing around with that. Comparative theology. And in order to do comparative theology, you cannot just read books that already agree with you. That's not doing it. So that's why I put Wayne Grudem over here. Wayne Grudem is a Reformed Trinitarian author who kind of gives the mainstream evangelical / Calvinistic position on any belief. And so it's a good go-to book for a very brief understanding. These systematic theology books are very brief understandings of any particular topic. But usually they have footnotes. And if you look in the footnotes and they're all quoting the same book, guess what? That book is probably a good book for you to invest in and research. There are also major book series that focus on multiple positions. So there's the Spectrum Multiview series of books. They have 27 books already published where they're going to give you multiple views in the same book, where the author is multiple authors and they're having the conversation in the book. Or the Counterpoints series. The Counterpoints series has 38 books. It's just incredible. And then I also want to mention the Foundations of Evangelical Theology series. It doesn't give you multiple positions, but it will just give you one position, but it does so in a very in-depth and helpful way, although it varies from author to author, which ones are better than others. There's no shortcut to actually reading a book, okay? You've got to move your eyes across the page. It takes forever, even for those of us who read lots of books and have been doing it for many years. It still takes us forever. It's an incredibly slow process. But if you're going to carefully understand someone's position, read the book and use your pen and underline things and argue back in the margin. Say, oh, that doesn't follow. Or if you spot a fallacy, write the fallacy in, right? And then if you see them using reasons, circle it, write reason number one and reason number two, right? That's how you really engage with somebody's work. Take notes as you go about their major points as well as any flaws in their reasoning. All right, on to number three in the comparative theology method after you find a good case and you take notes. Number three is work through the reasons for the other position. Are they strong? Are they logically valid? Are there fallacies? Are they biblically valid? Or is there a problem with the translation? Is there a problem with interpretation? Is there a problem with the manuscripts? If experiential, let's say somebody gives a reason based on their personal experience, is that personal experience valid? Does it apply to others as well? Or is it just a one-off? It depends on what kind of thing we're talking about. If they make a historical reason, if they give you a historical reason, look up the primary source. Go find the person that they're quoting and read. Does it really say what they're saying it says? What difficult texts are there for their position? And how would someone holding that position explain difficult texts and offer defeaters for their reasons? And then number four, work through the defeaters for your position. In reading somebody else's work who disagrees with you, they're going to take shots at your position. I hope they do, or else they're not doing a good job. And when they do, you need to write them down. Okay, well, this is what I believe, and they're saying that doesn't work because of this. Okay, write it down. Now, look into it. Is that valid or is it invalid? Are they strong? Can you defeat the defeaters that they brought up against your position? If you can't defeat the defeaters, then, you know, it might maybe a back burner issue where you just put it back on the burner. You're like, I'm going to think about that over the next, you know, year or so and see what comes up. Or if it's a very strong defeater, you may need to seriously consider changing your belief on whatever that position is. So in conclusion, comparative theology is really important. It's really important. Individuals need to do it. Churches need to do it. Denominations need to do it. But how? How can we do it? Nobody wants to do this. It's not fun. You know, let's say you believe that dead people are asleep. They're unconscious in the intermediate states. What I believe. Let's say you believe that. Well, a lot of other people think dead people are living in heaven right now. All right, so are you gonna have the chutzpah to go read a book by somebody who says that dead people are in heaven and give all their verses and all their reasons? Are you going to have the guts to do that? Or you just be like, oh no, they're all idiots. No, they're not all idiots. Sometimes they're idiots, but generally they're not all idiots. They just have different reasons than you have. And, you know, if what you believe is true, you're just going to strengthen your belief. And if it's false, why do you want to believe it? I don't want to believe anything false. I'm beating a dead horse now. Comparing doctrines is not part of our church's culture. It's not part of any church's culture that I know of. This is a weird thing to do, but I think it is a restorationist thing to do, and I therefore think it's a good thing to do, and it's something that I think is worth doing. We've made so much progress in moving along. We've looked at all these different aspects of Scripture and theology. This has now been our fifth session on theology. Biblical theology, systematic theology, analytic theology, historical theology, and comparative theology. So now, we're not done yet. We've got all the biblical and theological tools we need. It's time to pull it all together and actually do restoration theology. That's what we're going to get into next time. A method of evaluation. And my hope for this is that this will be the moment when all these different rivers flow together into one great understanding for the topic as we continue through our class on restoration theology.